Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to This is Labor in California, a podcast from Ogletree Deacons, where we bring you a monthly overview of traditional labor issues in California, along with how employers may be handling those issues. I'm Maria Anastas, based in our Los Angeles office, and today I'm joined by my colleagues, Daniel Adlong in Orange County and Sean Kramer in San Francisco. Today, we want to chat about what organized labor in California is doing about COVID-19, what they are up to with respect to legislation, and what we've been experiencing with union information requests during this pandemic. So for starters, let's talk a little bit about AB 685, because the business community has not reacted very favorably to this legislation for a variety of reasons. But since AB 685 impacts union and non-union workplaces, its reach is pretty broad. And so we thought it'd be valuable to spend a few minutes on it. This law was sponsored by the California Federation of Labor and the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Of all the unions out there, it's not surprising the UFCW would sponsor a bill like this because, at least from my perspective, the vast majority of their members are most likely essential workers and have probably been particularly impacted by COVID-19. The law requires employers to take certain actions within one business day receiving notice of potential exposure to COVID-19 from a qualifying individual. The law defines a qualifying individual as someone who has tested positive by a lab or a healthcare provider, someone who's been ordered to isolate or has died from COVID-19. And so let's talk a little bit about what employers are required to do under this new law. And the first requirement is they have to give notice to all their employees and the employers of subcontracted employees who are on the premises at the same work site as the qualifying individual within the infectious period, letting them know that they may have been exposed to COVID-19. And that notice, of course, has to be in English, but also the language understood by the majority of the employees.
Thanks, Maria. So in reacting to this, I believe California employers are likely to react pretty negatively to this requirement under the law once it becomes effective. Now, just so we're all aware, the new law takes effect and will be in effect from January 1st, 2021, until January 1st, 2023. Now, I think there's no denying, right, that AB 685 addresses a valid concern to ensure that a workforce is notified of potential exposure or exposure to the coronavirus. But the new law, it doesn't precisely define what constitutes quote-unquote exposure to a potentially infected person. Notice is required under the law when employees may have been exposed to COVID-19, which is incredibly vague. In other words, it's not clear in the current text of the new law when a person is potentially exposed to another with coronavirus. Now, the new law explains that notification requirements are triggered anytime a person is determined to be a qualifying individual or a person is exposed to a qualifying individual. As Maria just explained, a qualifying individual is defined, but exposure is not. And as most employers know by now, CDC guidance defines exposure as an individual who has had close contact, less than 6 feet for 15 minutes or greater, with a person known to have or suspected to have coronavirus. But that's not necessarily what exposure means under this new law. So let's take an example, right? So for instance, if an infected employee visits a worksite for, say, 5 minutes, wears a mask, drops off some paperwork, speaks to a colleague for a few minutes behind a protective plastic shield, and then leaves, would that qualify as potential exposure, triggering these notice requirements under the law? And how close does that contact need to be? And so I think as that example just showed, these are not just hypothetical questions. As the new law is drafted, employers have just merely one business day, not that much time at all, to determine exactly where the employee had been, exactly how close their contact was, and whether this constituted potential exposure at the work site under the law.
I forgot to mention, or haven't yet mentioned, I should say, that the same requirement with respect to that notice has to be provided to the exclusive representative, if there is one, at the employer's workplace. So that's, of course, a union representative. I'm sure Daniel has some thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I mean, as I hear this, I appreciate the fact that we are, as a community, concerned for our workers and want to make sure they're safe. But in light of the sponsors and in light of UFCW pushing this, this more feels to me as an avenue to find a hook to organize a group. I'm a bit skeptical of what they're seeking to pursue. This seems a lot like a previous law, AB 2455, that SEIU pushed in the home care space, which at that time was used to give out the name, telephone number, cell number in business where those employees worked. Here, it looks like having to give notice to a union rep gets the union involved more than I think any business wants. And I think it potentially just gives them the appearance that they're adding value when in fact that's not necessarily the case and that these employers are concerned and can take care of employees very well.
Yeah, I think that makes sense because some of the union campaigns we've handled during this pandemic have definitely been sparked by either concerns of a COVID outbreak at the workplace or concerns that employees have expressed regarding, you know, COVID pay or just extra pay for shifts due to COVID outbreaks. So I could see how it could be utilized as an organizing tool for sure. So the third requirement is that the employer provide all employees who may have been exposed and the union, if there is one, with information regarding COVID-19 related benefits to which the employee may be entitled under applicable federal, state, or local laws, including workers' comp, various leaves, and anti-retaliation and anti-discrimination protections.
Maria and Daniel, this is sort of another requirement under the new law that I believe employers are likely to react negatively to, as these requirements are largely duplicative of ones that are already in existing law. So just as another example, employers are already required to report serious illnesses and injuries to CalOSHA, which likely includes coronavirus. That reporting has to occur within 5 days or immediately, depending on the severity of the illness or injury. And employers are also already required to post and distribute leave policies. So it's not really clear what additional benefit this provides or this requirement provides, you know, other than to saddle employers with another administrative burden.
There's another notice requirement, which is to notify all employees and the employers of subcontracted employees and the exclusive representative, again, if there is one, on the employer's disinfection and safety plan that the employer plans to implement and complete per the guidelines of the Federal Centers for Disease Control. And if an employer is notified of the number of cases that meet the definition of a COVID-19 outbreak, as defined by the State Department of Public Health, within 48 hours, the employer has to notify the local public health agency of the names, number, occupation, and work site of employees who meet the definition of a qualifying individual. So I think this, back to your earlier point, Daniel, would really assist unions in identifying where they might be able to make some inroads from organizing, or do you see it differently?
No, I think that's very, very true. And I think this part in particular places an onus on an employer to think about employee engagement and employee communication. If you have a unionized group, for example, you need to figure out how do we want to communicate the message to employees, the timing, when do we communicate to the union, And we just need to make sure that we're communicating in such a way that we're transparent. The other things you want to give to consideration too is if you have susceptibility to organizing and you know that this is going to be reported and available to a labor organization, how do you communicate the information to employees and make sure that they understand we are concerned about them, that we communicate transparently, and they feel like they're having all the information they need available to them. And they also feel like to the extent they have questions, we're diligently answering them. I think those things are really important as you go about this, because having to make these reports, it's easy fodder for organizing, and it really places an onus on an employer to think about engagement, to think about a communication, and really knock it out of the park to make sure employees see that we have their best interests at heart and they don't need a labor organization.
I think that's right. And, you know, when this was still proposed legislation before the governor signed the bill, Sean, we had talked a little bit and you had made a good point about AB 685 potentially expanding liability under PAGA. And I think it would be worthwhile for you to just kind of weigh in on that, even for just a couple of minutes, because I think it's a critical point you had made.
Yeah, thanks, Maria. And I agree. And this is my final point on this new law. And so, yeah, I think it's certainly possible, or at least arguable, that this new law could expand liability under PAGA or the Private Attorneys General Act. And as most employers in California likely know, they likely have seen these claims before, PAGA authorizes aggrieved employees to file lawsuits to recover civil penalties on behalf of themselves, other employees, and the state of California for labor code violations. So, you know, the way that most attorneys refer to this law is that it allows employees to step into the shoes of the state of California and enforce the labor code, or enforce violations of the labor code. So this particular new law, since it amends the labor code, and because public entities are explicitly listed in the new law as part of the definition of employers, arguably public employers could now be subject to PAGA-related litigation for violating this section of the labor code, as could private employers. Now, as to public entities, this is a notable departure from what the current law, PAGA law, says.
Even without AB 685, organized employers have been dealing with COVID-19 related information requests since the start of this pandemic. And like any other type of information request an employer receives from a union, we always believe that the best approach is to review it thoroughly, make sure you understand what they're asking for, and if they've identified a deadline, which is normally the case, figure out whether you think it's reasonable or not. So best practice for me is to respond right away to the union with at least a note that indicates that you've received their request, and letting them know you'll be in touch. Because when the NLRB evaluates unfair labor practice charges involving refusals to provide information, they focus on whether the employer even bothered to respond to the union's request and the timeframes involved. So I just like to keep that information ball in the air right at the outset, even if I disagree with the substance of a union's information requests, even if we don't, you know, feel that all of their requests are relevant. What I've seen during the pandemic, and I'd like to hear from both of you as well, is that some of the more clever unions, or maybe it's their lawyers, have sometimes used written guidance from Cal OSHA and converted that guidance into, you know, 17, 20 page information requests, not realizing perhaps that the guidance memo from Cal OSHA is not only outdated, but it's just that, it's guidance. I don't know, maybe it's a nice try on the part of organized labor, but employers are not legally mandated to implement guidance from any agency.
So I've seen information requests in this space, and I think it's really interesting because they're going to run the gamut. For example, if you are operating a nursing home or a medical facility, that's going to put you in a position where you might have more exposure. Whereas if, for example, I've advised a lot of food service businesses and warehouses recently, and that puts you in another different position. And when you're responding to these information requests, you make a good point, Maria, about the importance of putting it up in the air and letting them, acknowledging it and letting it sit out there. And while you have it sit out there, I just think it's really important for businesses that they run through a series of considerations regarding how they want to answer. Like, do they want to be forthcoming? Do they want to be circumspect? Are they somewhere in between? The timing that they have with respect to responding back, how quick or how slow do they want to respond to the union? The other thing to consider is risk tolerance. And in my mind, all these things come into play because frequently a business seems to feel like we have a duty to provide information. The union asks for this information. And typically I see these information requests, they try to give it as some authoritative thing. They cite the National Labor Relations Act and excoriate us for not giving the information quick enough or promptly enough. And I think it's just important that as a business, you look at how can we comply with the law, but make sure we're given an answer that we want and we provide the information that we want and not just give everything and play into these fishing expeditions that the unions frequently try to use to then go maybe create fodder for other employee discontent.
Yeah, I always tell clients when they get a really lengthy information request to just take a deep breath and understand that we can evaluate each request based on whether or not the information they're seeking is relevant. You certainly don't have to provide the information on the deadline that the union, you know, inserts in their letter. If it's reasonable to take more time, and most of the time it is, then we, you know, work on getting the information, you know, when the employer is able to provide it. But I think it's just important to always remember the mere fact that they're asking for information doesn't mean they're entitled to it. And it's just a best practice, like I said, to at least acknowledge you got the request and then evaluate the extent to which you're going to provide the information and the timetable. How about you, Sean?
So yeah, I can speak to my experience and my practice with clients receiving information requests from unions, you know, related to COVID type categories. So at least most recently, I've had a series of clients receive information requests related to policies and procedures that, you know, the clients are implementing in response to the pandemic that that impact bargaining unit employees. Now, I think, you know, employers have to think very critically about responding to these types of information requests because unions are likely entitled to find out about what steps the employers are taking to keep unit employees safe during the pandemic. And requests for information regarding benefits and whatnot that touch on employees' terms and conditions of employment are likely to also be relevant topics for union requests for information. So just to give an example of a request that one of our clients has received, here are the requests. The facility's specific infection control and occupational health plan for COVID-19, a copy of site-specific comprehensive programs that integrate the CDC's COVID guidance, and a copy of the facility's policy on pay and benefits protections for workers who are placed on a precautionary removal from their normal work because of COVID-19 exposure. Now, as Maria alluded to a little bit earlier, the unions are not just justifying these requests under the National Labor Relations Act. They're also pulling in OSHA and the agency's guidance. So in this case, the union's rationale for requesting this information was because the facility's quote-unquote preparedness plan for the coronavirus was a major concern to union members, and they asserted that the union was entitled to this information under both the NLRA and OSHA. So if I were to offer just a generic piece of advice is when confronting these types of information requests, including for COVID-19 specific related policies and procedures, employers should just keep in mind that when the requests are dealing directly with bargaining unit employees, wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment, that information is probably relevant and germane to the union information request and probably needs to be provided.
In our next podcast, we will continue our roundtable with a discussion about employee refusals to work, whether they are related to COVID-19 or other employee concerns. Daniel and Sean, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.